On Soul Search today, growing up Muslim in Australia. Real people rather than stereotypes. True stories rather than myths. The recent catastrophe in Christchurch underscores just how urgently things need to be different.
I am shocked that it was New Zealand, probably one of the most peaceful countries on the planet that I could think of. And there's something even more galling about the alleged perpetrator having chosen New Zealand as a place to do this. And I think the shock of the proximity of this has meant that for many people like myself, it really hit home. For geographic proximity, for spiritual proximity, I think in those both those realms, there was a sense that this could have been anyone I know. This could have been me, could have been my kids, could have been my son. There's a lot of raw emotion to still navigate through, and I expect it'll take some time before everybody collectively reaches a point where they can start to move on. I don't think it'll ever be forgotten, but I think our capacity to learn from it will define who we are.
Tasneen Chopra with her response to the recent attack on Muslims in Christchurch and a call to learn from the calamity as a community. The stakes are obviously high, and I suspect it's deep learning that's needed. Well, Tasneem herself is a cross-cultural consultant, curator, and activist. She's the chair of the Australian Muslim Women's Centre for Human Rights and one of 12 contributors to the book Growing Up Muslim in Australia. She talks about the difference being a Muslim makes to her life and experience, even, as it turned out, to the experience of having a routine immunisation as a high school kid.
This scene took place in Bendigo last century. So we're talking about a country town in another time altogether. And I was a proverbial brown pea in a white pod on many levels, one of which was the fact that I was the only Muslim student in my class in high school at the time. And I recall walking into the sick bay to get my jab as per the standard for, and I think it was the rubella jab from memory. And while lining up for it, it was routine to get a jelly bean just to ease the sting, which is fine. However, at the time I was fasting because it was the month of Ramadan. And I never made a big hoopla out of it in a big way. I mean, I can recall not eating at lunchtime and friends would be asking, why aren't you eating? But I had the jab and the nurse put the jelly baby in my mouth and I happily ate it, not thinking twice about the fact that I was fasting because I was focusing on the pain.
Sure.
That was my main priority to get through. Then as I swallowed the jelly baby, obviously I hadn't eaten for most of the day, so I suddenly became very self-aware of what was inside me. And then I realised, oh my God, I'm fasting. And being at that young age and not having a fully formed view of, you know, I guess the rules and the minutiae of what faith encompasses, I was thinking that fire and brimstone would come upon me because I had broken this pillar of my faith. And I was totally devastated. And I was telling my friends, I was saying, guess what I just did? I just ate a jelly baby. And they're like, so what? So did I. I said, but I'm fasting. And they're like, so what? And I think their nonchalance both shocked me but also grounded me a little bit too. And it kind of brought me back, like, I'm still standing. There has been no fire, no brimstone. The earth has not ended. I have not been swallowed up whole. So I sort of calmed down considerably after. But at the time, I think it was reflective of how my experience of faith was very much centred around no reference point. It was just what I understood it to be, and every little thing, big or small, became amplified because I was learning through it and learning myself what it meant to be growing up Muslim in Australia.
Can I ask you about your early childhood, your favourite memories, really, of being a kid in Bendigo at that time?
One of my favourite things was after school, throwing my bag down, picking up my bike and riding to the park with no helmet, no flag. Shoes. No guarantee there were shoes. And just spending my afternoon there with friends, catching up, climbing the monkey bars, making cubby houses. There was a creek not far from the playground, which we'd go to. And I remember a couple of times trying to catch yabbies in the creek. And to which my kids are like, what are yabbies? Okay, fine. I even had a leech. So the leech, the yabbies, the bike rides, the cubby houses, the play equipment. The fact that I was probably the only coloured kid in the playground, but not being made to feel too conscious of that for the most part after a while, because I just became one of the kids in the neighbourhood. There were times when I was made to feel different, and that was specifically when I was about 7 years old and I was heading towards the corkscrew slide in the centre of the playground. And the rule of the slide is you don't push in, you wait for whoever's in front to go. But as I was walking in towards it, this kid from behind came running, pushed in front of me. So being, you know, well brought up, I let it go. And he proceeded to go up. Now, this boy had red hair and freckles and blue eyes. I'll never forget him. His name was Ewan. So Ewan just pushed in, went up ahead. And I stood there and I waited. But he didn't seem to be coming down. So I proceeded to go up to see what the deal was. And he just sat there waiting and waiting, blocking my progress, which is a metaphor, I think. And eventually he got flustered and red and he turned around and he blurted out to me, "Why are you brown?"
Right. Wow.
Now, I was 7 and I'd never had been confronted with that before. It was one of those elephant in the room things that had just come out and accost me. And I came up with the first thing that I could in my mind and I stared him down and I said, "Because Ewan, God put me in the toaster and you missed out." Right. And then I shoved him aside and I went down the slide. I felt freaking fabulous. Yeah. That was one time when my difference was brought home to me as an accusation because I didn't look like everybody else. But it became interesting because that was, I think, the turning point for me, realising that I could hold my own when I was challenged. And, you know, there were little episodes in life that have presented Ewans to me in more than one occasion, from the media, from government, from colleagues, from, you know, colleagues at school, and people that I'm constantly coming across, and dodging the Ewans and sailing down the slide has become a lot harder. And there are far more obstacles on the slide than there used to be, but I still insist that I can get down that slide myself.
There have been Muslim residents of Bendigo since at least the gold rushes of the 1850s. So it's not a new thing for your family to be there. But can you tell me about your family and how they did come to live in Bendigo?
So my family left Kenya, where I was born, in the early 70s. So post the reign of Idi Amin in Uganda, where there was at the time a great number of people, Indian expats or Indian Africans who'd been there for some time, who were being either forcibly removed from their homes or having to make tough decisions about relocating. My father and mum that decided the time had come for them, even though we're 5 generations in East Africa, the time had come to think about relocating. It had come push to shove. And my dad worked for the Commonwealth in Nairobi for a hospital there. He was a pathologist. And at the same time in Australia, the White Australia policy had just been lifted. And there was a call out to increase, I guess, the skill cap of the population because there was a deficit and there was a shortage of particularly medical practitioners of that ilk. So my dad initially had made a plan to, I guess, almost like a reconnaissance to check out Australia before we all came. And he initially went to Darwin, where we were supposed to settle. And he checked it out. He wasn't really sure. He spent some time, went back to Africa, and about literally a week after he left, Cyclone Tracy happened. So it was like, yep, forget Darwin. But we did end up in Alice Springs. So I spent the first 9 months of my life, almost a year, in Alice. And if you can imagine moving from Nairobi, which is a temperate climate, that literally a city that sits on the equator, where I think the average temperature is 24 degrees every day for the year, to Alice Springs, which was scorched, parched desert, red sand, dirt, heat. Let's just say my mother did not take too well to that. It was a little bit too much on many levels. I think the culture shock to go from, I guess, what was essentially a very, you know, black and brown world to white Australia and heat and dirt. So they looked around, and then my dad managed to get a secondment to Bendigo, which at the time Victoria was known as the Garden State. We came down to Victoria and I believe they chose a city for a few reasons. The first was culture shock, coming from, you know, an environment where they were completely at ease with everyone they knew, which was Nairobi, and such a long-standing network of support. They thought that it'd be easier to nurture that in a small country town than in a big city. They also had 3 daughters, and I think that played a big factor in, like, we're not bringing our 3 girls up in the big city till we know what we're dealing with, kind of thing. So as much as I resented being in a country town and wanting to leave my entire life, I can see the wisdom of it now as a parent, and what would I do in a similar situation? So they did move. But I should point out, while we were in Alice, although my dad was a pathologist, he actually was co-opted by the Flying Doctor Service and would actually fly out to remote Aboriginal communities and treat them. And there was a story he told once where, when he was treating some Indigenous communities there, the elders actually approached him and were so happy to see a coloured doctor come and treat them. They called him brother, and they said, "We're so glad that one of our people has come to help us," you know. So I think that's a story that I kind of take a lot of pride in, because it shows that even from that age, there was a connection with the First Nations people that made me feel welcome. And fast forwarding to when I was in Bendigo in grade two, I remember being in the playground and kids teasing me, calling me an Aboriginal, like it was a slur. And when they said that to me and said it as a slur, I felt it as a slur. I didn't know what it meant to be an Aboriginal, other than apparently it's a bad thing because they're saying it to me in that way. And I remember bringing this up with a friend of mine who lived in Melbourne, and her brother said to her and to me, because both of us had been called Aboriginals, and he said, "If anyone calls you an Aboriginal, you should be proud, because they're the true Australians." When he said that to me, it was like, wow. What, it's amazing how perception can be spun according to whose agenda it serves. And I think that was a really, really pivotal lesson for me. I think in many ways it kind of informed the philosophy that I have, is the history that we learn, you have to ask before you read the history, is who's writing that history, and then you'll get a better understanding of what's being said.
This is Soul Search, and I'm Meredith Lake, speaking with Tasneem Chopra. Her parents migrated from Kenya to Bendigo, where there weren't many other Muslim families in the 1970s and 80s.
There were students there from Malaysia and China, Malaysia and Indonesia, and actually there was a couple from East Africa as well, which was interesting. But in terms of the Muslim cohort, there was a handful. So my mother would make a concerted effort during, I guess, the spiritual times, during Ramadan and during the Eid festivities, which follow Ramadan and follow the Hajj, with his, it's like a Christmas celebration. She made an effort to call them over for a dinner, because they were boarding students, they had no family here. And it became a way of them feeling like they had a home, and also for us feeling like we had a semblance of a community. Otherwise, it was just, I think, about a handful of families in the whole township that made up the Muslim community of Bendigo in the 70s and 80s.
Tasneem, there was no mosque in Bendigo while you were a child there. So when did you first visit one?
So my first visit to a mosque was one of our gazillion trips to Melbourne. And I remember, again, it would have been when I was in primary school. And Preston Mosque, I think, if I'm not wrong, it was one of the first mosques built in Victoria. So we went along to it, and I'd heard about this mosque business and I wanted to check it out. So my dad's, remember parking in the car park, and then the women's section was up a stairwell. So I'm like, okay, let's go up. And I was immediately struck by the serenity of the place. You could hear a pin drop in the silence, and you move your shoes when you enter a mosque, so you could feel the carpet squish under your toes. So I felt the soft plush carpet that my feet would sink into, and above my head there was a dome that was made of coloured perspex of blue and red and purple and green. So as I looked up, it was like the light was shining through the perspex dome onto this floor with the soft carpet, and there was complete silence. And I have to say, it was one of the most surreal experiences. And
very vivid.
But I'll never forget it. And I remember sitting down and just kneeling and taking it in, looking left and looking right and thinking, wow, this is like the mosques I read about. And I think from that particular point, I kind of felt a connection to my faith that I hadn't felt until that point. Until then, it was very much ritual. It was a thing we do. We fast, we pray, we do this, we do that. But there wasn't a point of anchorage. I kind of feel that first time that I went into a mosque, it was like, okay, this is pretty cool. I really like this. I kind of get it. It resonates. It works with me. And it felt really good.
How do you think growing up in Bendigo might have been different for you had there been a mosque in the town at that time?
Oh, well, just based on that one experience, I mean, I'm thinking, yeah, it would have been fantastic. But logistically, I don't see how it would have been a feasibility with only like 5, maybe 10 families. You couldn't really justify it. If the numbers are what they are today, which I believe are hundreds, then yeah, it would have been great to have a centre place to go where you could, A, have a spiritual connection and centre. But mosques are so much more, and I believe the mosques, the mosque that's being built in Bendigo is beyond just a place of worship. There is going to be a hall, a facility there where you can hire out for functions. You can have, you know, classes and lessons there. You could have women's groups. You could have taekwondo lessons. I mean, you could do any kind of thing in a multi-purpose facility.
It's a community centre.
It is a community centre. And so by definition, that's not just the Muslim community. It opens itself up to, I believe, to the wider community to use, because it is precisely for that reason. The same way you can hire a church hall. And I think, you know, people need to take the fear-mongering out of what this means. It's a facility. The fact that it's adjacent to a mosque is as meaningful as a community hall being next to a church. It doesn't mean I'm going to be proselytized if I go to a blue light disco at the hall next to a church, which is a common thing in Bendigo, by the way. it just happened that way, but no one blinked an eye at it. And so there's a lot of unnecessary hysteria that has surrounded the proposed mosque in Bendigo, which I think is a reflection of paranoia, ignorance, and political agenda.
Tasneem, you went to an Anglican high school, I understand. Mm-hmm. One time, a guest speaker at a religious education class there made some derogatory comments about the Prophet Muhammad. This is mm-hmm. when you were in middle high school.
That's right.
How did you react to that experience as a teenager?
My heart stopped. And I had a visceral reaction. I felt my heart racing and pounding so loudly that the guy next to me, I remember his name is Dougal, he said, "Are you okay?" And I just looked at him and I couldn't speak. And I knew I had to say something, because after that I saw the guest speaker's mouth moving, but I couldn't hear what he was saying. I literally was having an out-of-body experience because I had been so offended and hurt by that. But I knew I had to articulate something beyond putting up my hand and looking like the blood had drained from my face. So I did put up my hand and I felt I need to defend my faith according to me, because I have been, that what he said is really, really offensive, and there's no counterpoint to that. He gets to say something, which is a mirror for pretty much everything that's happened in our political landscape ever since. But there was no counterpoint to what he had said. So I said the best that I could without, and I was trying to find response somewhere between showing how deeply offended I was, but showing respect because he was a guest. And I was, A, brought up well, and B, you know, at an Anglican private school. So there's certain P's and Q's I had to be mindful of. So trying to navigate all of that, I put up my hand and I said to him, "Don't you think it's more a matter of opinion than fact to say that about the Prophet?" And then the blood drained from his face, and rightfully so. And he goes, "Oh, look, okay, no, that's not what I mean." And I literally remember him saying, "Some of my best friends are Muslim." I thought, oh, that's gold. That was the first time I heard that as the xenophobic excuse for not being xenophobic. Some of my best friends, you know, are black or brown.
Through high school, in the summer holidays, you had other experiences with people of faith and people from your own faith tradition at Muslim youth camps. Can you tell me what that was like for you and how that shaped your sense of yourself as a teenager?
The Muslim youth camps were a novelty. I was introduced to probably in my mid to late teens, and they were absolutely fantastic because I suddenly saw a diversity to the face of Islam, which until then had been either on my TV screen or the few families that I had in Bendigo, which were Indonesian and Egyptian. So suddenly I was, you know, thrown into this environment where I saw Muslims from Bosnia and Turkey and South Africa and Somalia and New Zealand. I mean, they were just from everywhere. And it gave me a wonderful sense of, I think, global identity, that Islam is a faith that is universal. It's not just something that's geographical. And that felt really wonderful. It was kind of a liberating, educating experience at the same time.
And Tasneem, in your writing, you've said that you wouldn't trade your Australian story for anything. But what do you think does need to change to ensure the well-being of people who are growing up Muslim in Australia today?
I would like to hope that if anything changed, it was a climate of acceptance. And I mean, I grew up in Australia. I grew up in country Victoria, a very strong sense of belonging. And when I've had comments made to the effect of "go back to where you've come from or where you came from," I know they don't mean Bendigo. I know they mean Kenya, or they mean somewhere brown. That to me is really, really unsettling, that we can still be having a conversation that makes that a viable excuse. So acknowledging that this country was built on migration, and the contribution that people have been making to that effect, I think when that is presented as fact to leaders and politicians and media pundits, facts shouldn't, we can't dispute facts. We can dispute whether we like them or not, but we can't dispute the content of them. And I think that is a very big difference. So we need to shift from allowing judgment of facts from being dominant over the actual content of facts, and that would make a big difference.
Well, thank you, Tasneem, for sharing your story today. Thanks for joining Soul Search.
Thanks, Meredith.
Tasneem Chopra, a cross-cultural consultant, author and activist, who first discovered the huge diversity of Muslim communities in Australia at the holiday youth camps she attended as a school student. Well, that diversity is on full display in a book published by Allen and Unwin, Growing Up Muslim in Australia. A new edition was released just in February, and we'll put the details on the Soul Search webpage. You can also catch up there with any of our stories that you might have missed.